Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 25th of March, and I have the great pleasure to welcome on this podium the UNDP resident representative in Chad, Francis James, who is here to brief you on the humanitarian situation of women and girls at the border with Sudan. Je vous en prie.
Thank you, Alessandra. Hello, everyone. Assalamu alaikum. Hope everyone is having a good Ramadan. To those that are participating, listen. A pleasure to be here this morning. My name is Francis James. I'm the UNDP resident representative in Chad. Just want to talk a little bit about the context of Chad. Chad, surrounded by Libya, Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, Sudan, Central African Republic. It's kind of an island surrounded by a lot of instability and a lot of challenges. Right now, it's the fourth, and the Human Development Index. I think we're a little bit better than Somalia, and South Sudan, Niger, and not much more. But and we're also buffeted by the refugee crisis on the eastern part of the border. There are currently, as of Sunday, 769,000 refugees and displaced persons, and about 170 of those are returnees, estimated to probably top a million by the end of the year. So it's very much a humanitarian crisis on the border. There are about 18 refugee camps and installations, and it's a very, very challenging situation. That's on the eastern border. On the western border, we have the Lake Chad region. We have about 750,000 displaced people fighting a lot of insecurity from Boko Haram, Islamic State, and Western Africa. In the south, you have about 200,000 returnees and refugees from Central African Republic. So again, a very challenging situation. But there is hope. And that's the message that I want to say today. There's a new government that has taken hold. There is a series of five elections over 10 months. There's a new young president, 40 years old, dynamic. There's a Plan National de Développement. There's 12 chantiers sans action. There is a roadmap for development. So the period of transition is over, as they say, and we're now en pleine voie de développement. We're really into our development plan. And so that's where agencies like UNDP, like UNICEF, like FAO, and others are really putting the stress on the development angle, notwithstanding the fact that there's a humanitarian crisis going on, certainly on the border areas. One of the emphasis that we're doing is, and I'll take a particular example, is this creation. We had the visit of Amina Mohammed last August, and she committed to building a women's support center, a women's center in Adre, which is literally on the border. It's a small village on the border with Sudan, and asked UNDP, UNICEF, UNFPA to contribute to building a women's center, a women's support center that would address the concerns of refugees and returnees and also the locally displaced. Let's not forget that you have, with this influx of 700 or so thousand, if I could just put that in context, the population of Geneva, Zurich, and Bern is less than the refugee population on the eastern border. So that's something to think about. The refugees are also displacing a lot of the local populations and causing tensions. And so the idea is to have this creation of a women's center, a platform for women that are subject to violence, violence basée sur le genre, and other psychosocial contexts. And so the idea was to offer a platform for these women and girls to develop skills, work on social cohesion, interact with local communities, and have opportunities for vocational training, and to build a better lifestyle and a better and hope. So I guess my call today is, we need to invest in social protection for women and girls. We need to invest in development, and investing in development is a surefire way, and particularly in women and girls, of combating the humanitarian crisis, and it really pays off in the end. I don't know if there are any questions or any observations. Over.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup, Francis, pour cette introduction. I'm opening the floor to questions. If there is any in the room, don't see any hand up. Let me see on the platform. I don't see. I'll leave you one more minute if there's anybody who wants to ask a question. No, it doesn't seem so. So thank you very much for this update. I think it's very important to highlight things that are not necessarily on the headlines. C'est très important, donc merci beaucoup d'être passé nous voir à l'occasion de votre visite à Genève.
Merci.
Bonne continuation. So let me go now to James. Can you? Yes. James is coming to the podium. James, you brought us today Peter Hawkins, who is the UNICEF representative in Yemen. And Peter, I understand, is connecting from Sana'a to tell us about the situation of children there after so many years of conflict. You want to start, or I'll give the floor to Peter directly?
Very briefly. Thanks so much, Al-Sahra. Yes, Peter has been in Yemen for years now, is a very experienced hand. Obviously, we are at the 10-year mark, if you can believe that, 10 years, imagine what that means to a 15-year-old. So it's overdue to give a sense of what the situation is for children now. So over to the head of office, Peter.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, James. And thanks, everybody. It's great to see you today from Sana'a here. As the previous speaker says, sometimes it's very difficult to get these countries on the agenda, but Yemen is on the agenda, but all for the wrong things, signaling different elements to different ways of working. But today here, we're really talking about the impact of 10 years of conflict in Yemen, which has reached a tragic milestone. This unrelenting conflict, while it has had periods where we have had fragile but reduced hostilities, those periods have not really allowed women, girls, and boys to reassess, reorganize themselves. These constant threats, these constant risks that they're faced with has really diminished their ability to become resilient. Today is about the women, girls, and boys. One in two children under the age of five are malnourished in Yemen today. This is a statistic that is almost unparalleled across the world. Among them are over 540,000 girls and boys who are severely and acute malnourished, a condition that is agonizing, life-threatening, and entirely preventable, especially for those children who are in the 30 percentile away from service delivery, in the most remote areas, up on the mountains and down, right deep down in the valleys of northern Yemen. Malnutrition weakens immune systems, stunts growth, and robs children of their potential. Equally alarming are the 1.4 million pregnant and lactating women who are malnourished. That is perpetrating a vicious circle of intergenerational suffering and degradation. This catastrophe is not natural. It is man-made. Over a decade of conflict has decimated Yemen's economy, healthcare system, and infrastructure. Even during periods of reduced violence, the structural consequences of the conflict, especially for girls and boys, have remained severe. More than half the population relies on humanitarian assistance, externally driven. Food prices have soared to over 300% over the past 10 years. Critical ports and roads, lifelines for food and medicine are damaged and blockaded. Despite these incredibly difficult and often dangerous operating environments, we as UNICEF and the UN remain on the ground delivering life-saving assistance to girls and boys. In 2025, we continue to support, as UNICEF, 3,200 health facilities. These are life-saving facilities to provide MNNCH, immunization and nutritional support. The treatment of over 600,000 malnourished children, 70 mobile teams and 42,000 community health workers in 27 therapeutic feeding centers. For this to continue, we need sustained funding over time. Our 2025 appeal is only 25% funded. Without urgent resources, we cannot sustain even the minimal services we're able to provide in the face of growing needs. Time is of essence. To be able to achieve this, we need to move fast. I was in Hodeidah over the past 3 days at the port city. I went through the western lowlands where there are people on the streets, on the side of the roads, begging and looking for assistance. They have given up. We cannot give up. In the last month in Taiz, for example, in the south of Yemen, I met a three-year-old girl called Amina. Her mother walked 12 kilometers in search of a clinic, clutching Amina's skeletal frame. Today, following treatment in that center, Amina is recovering, but her future hinges on whether we can sustain that support or not. This hinges on two critical things. One, funding the response fully. We need an additional 157 million for our response in 2025. This is urgently need life-saving response. We need sustained investment in fighting the forms of malnutrition into 2026. We cannot stop at the end of 2025 and say, inshallah, get on with it. We need to continue that assistance. The lack of education and other forms of suffering children in Yemen are forced to endure is unparalleled. Second, protecting humanitarian access. All parties to the conflict, and I saw for myself yesterday an enormously damaged property, which injured in the bombing of yesterday, injured three children. Eight children have died in the most recent airstrikes across northern Yemen. Yemen must be allowed unimpeded delivery of aid and allow humanitarians to do what they do best, which is, at this point in time, all we can do is save lives. We call for the release of the detained UN staff and other humanitarian workers, and importantly, for all to move towards a position where Yemen can look at peace rather than respond to the conflict. Yemen's children cannot wait another decade. They need peace today and tomorrow. They need justice. But above all, they need us to act now. Let us not fail them. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much for this briefing, Peter. I'll open the floor to questions. I see none in the room, so on the platform. Moussa Assi Al-Mayedine. Bonjour, Moussa. Vous pouvez ouvrir votre micro. Ah voilà, maintenant on devrait vous ouvrir.
C'est bon maintenant.
Allez-y. C'est bon. En anglais, s'il vous plaît.
Merci beaucoup. Yeah. Regarding the recent US and UK bombing of Yemen, is there a direct impact on your work and the work of other organization, humanitarian organization, and the humanitarian situation in general in Yemen? Thank you.
Peter, we answer every question interview style. So if you can go ahead.
The current airstrikes are very targeted, so they don't have wider impact. But for those immediately around them, and we have staff who have been impacted, it is incredibly traumatic. As I said in my thing, we verified 8 children have been killed in these airstrikes. but it doesn't necessarily impact the operation itself. Where it does have an impact, and this is more general, is access to ports, access to both seaports and airports, access to be able to move freely. And those two things are integral to any humanitarian assistance. And obviously any conflict has an impact on a population as a whole, especially a disproportionate impact on girls and boys.
Moussa, I see your hand still up. I don't know if it's a follow-up.
No, merci, j'ai oublié ma
lèvée. Okay. Agnès Pedrero, AFP.
Yes, thank you. I have one question to UNICEF, but do you hear me?
I hope Peter hears you better than Naz.
It's a question to UNICEF more generally, so I don't know if I can ask now, and one other about
not
Sudan.
Not on Yemen.
No, not on Yemen.
Okay, just wait, because there are many other questions, so I'll give you the floor later on. Nick Cumming-Bruce, The New York Times.
Yeah, thank you. A couple of questions. Could you just confirm, is the port infrastructure, particularly Hodeida, but any of the ports that are servicing imports of humanitarian assistance, is that all functioning normally? Has there been any damage to that in the course of recent airstrikes? You mentioned 8 children were killed. In what part of Yemen were those 8 children killed? And thirdly, to what extent is your nutritional program affected by recent USAID cuts? Thank you.
Peter.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you very much. I think I'll take the latter one first. I think the issue with the USAID cuts is that it's diminished the capacity overall here in Yemen quite extensively. We have been able to continue our programs, but a nutritional program needs to be complemented by food assistance and in turn complemented by cash assistance that allows for a better response to a nutritional crisis. It is the second and third part, and especially the multisectoral response that is compromised, and therefore it makes our job much more difficult in terms of sustaining and being effective in that sense. In the terms of the airstrikes and the damage to infrastructure, as everyone knows, the airstrikes have been going on for pretty well just over a year. I suppose the most recent airstrikes in December, where the ports were, November and December, where the ports were excessively attacked, that diminished the capacity of Hodeida Port by about 50%. The tugs were destroyed, which is compromising the large shipments coming in and out. And then everyone would have heard about the strike on the airport. I was actually there myself, where the issue about international humanitarian law and safeguarding the access to civilian infrastructure is critical. The airport is still functioning, but it shows the fragility of that sort of thing.
Thank you very much. Our next question is from Olivia Le Poitvin, Reuters.
Hi there. Thank you for this briefing. My question is that recently, last week, MSF said that malnutrition is growing in Yemen and that the needs are outpacing current treatment capacity, and they say they've also seen, you know, a constant kind of increase in admissions for malnutrition. Are you able to share your commentary on that? Are you seeing the same thing? And maybe you can give a few numbers in terms of numbers of admissions that you're seeing. And I don't know if you can give us indicate any kind of shape in terms of if the numbers are steadying or are getting worse. And then my follow-up question to that will be, You're saying your programs are continuing as normal, but how concerned are you in terms of the potential impact in terms of malnutrition by those other programs that you mentioned, food and cash assistance being cut, and the impact that could have on your work?
Olivia, thanks a lot for that. And MSF and UNICEF work very, very closely together, and I followed their appeal on last Thursday, I think, very closely. And I was hoping they would be with me today. But they're seeing the consequences of the failure of being able to deliver assistance, especially in that 30% area of the very remote areas. And that's what we are focusing on. So what we've agreed with the MSF to take the pressure off them, we will extend mobile teams into the most remote areas with our community workers, so that the plumpy nut, which is the commodity we use to alleviate severe and acute malnutrition, is delivered in the homestead, in the community itself, preventing children from becoming too malnourished and therefore having to be referred to MSF centres or our own TFCs. And we're working very closely to ensure that combination works well. They're doing a fantastic job, as indeed are our mobile teams and the teams working in the 3,200 primary healthcare centres across the country. How will it impact? The shock of the lack of food distribution in 2024, I think, is quite severe on this population. We saw mortality rates of 41 in 1,000, which had meant that it had dropped slightly over the past 3 years, 4 years, which is a good sign that our interventions have had an impact. But that resilience with any shock shows a high degree of fragility. And the lack of general food distribution in 2024 and a reduced one. WFP have managed to reach 2.1 million people already this year. UNICEF was able to reach with cash in 2024 1.45 million families, 9.6 million people. All of that is helping to build or sustain the situation. But if any of that goes, then there will be a dramatic fall in malnutrition or an increase, in malnutrition and in high-risk MAM and severe and acute malnutrition. To an extent, I mean, we've seen figures of 33% severe and acute malnutrition in certain areas, especially along the West Coast, which is where I was in Hodeidah, and that is on the verge of, a catastrophe. It's not a humanitarian crisis, it's not an emergency, it is a catastrophe where thousands will die.
Thank you very much. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you, Alessandra, for taking my question. I wanted to just come back to the situation of strikes that Musa had brought up earlier. Sir, could you tell us what your reaction is to this information about U.S. officials chatting about airstrikes that were conducted in Yemen? And if you could, what the human rights or civilian death implications might have been for that, and just your reaction to reading about that, and any from Yemenis that you regularly speak with how they might have reacted as well. Thank you.
Obviously, it's beyond my competence to react to those reports. All I can say is the all airstrikes in Yemen diminish the infrastructure and increase the fear that is taking place across northern Yemen. Luckily, the most recent airstrikes have not been targeted to infrastructure like the ports or or other areas that directly affect us. And we just call for everyone to, now is the time when the Yemen to Yemen peace agreement should be at its peak. That is the only thing that is available to Yemen for peace. And one hopes that all the protagonists can come together and say, okay, the situation for the civilian population in Yemen is acute. Let's try and bring about peace, and let's try and invest in that peace through a response to the humanitarian crisis, which is evolving all the time.
Thank you very much, sir. I don't see a specific question on this, so I'll give the floor to Agnes. I don't know exactly on which matter, but we're here.
Yes, so I have some questions, but first a follow-up on Yemen. You mentioned that the food and the cash assistance were compromised. Does that mean effective cuts, or if you could clarify that point? And okay, with the rest. So more globally with UNICEF, I see that you have published a report on the impact of the budget difficulties and the fact that more children will die. But we were wondering if you have more specific examples, concrete examples of how vaccine programs will be impacted, maybe totally stopped or interrupted. And the other question is to the other spokesperson in general on the strike. Just a second, on the strike in Sudan. If you in North Darfur, if you have any information about this strike and about details about the toll. Yes, thank you.
Okay, so maybe I'll ask Peter to answer the question about Yemen. James the second, and I'm looking at Jens if you have anything on Sudan, no, or Margaret, rather, or maybe you have something, James. But let's start with Peter for the question on Yemen. Sorry, I haven't introduced you. Agnes is our correspondent of AFP. Sorry.
Okay, I'll be very quick and then hand over to James. In 2024, for various reasons, there was a pause on general food distribution. WFP have done an exceptional job to make sure that 2.1 million people have received food so far in 2025. We at UNICEF intensified our nutrition response in 2024, and we've increased that and retargeted that to the most vulnerable. We're also retargeting our unconditional cash transfer, so it has greater impact on the more vulnerable populations in the geographical areas where it is most in need. And we hope to be able to continue that, as indeed we did in 2024, with two payments in September and in December this year.
I mean, specifically on vaccines, we are still unpacking how much damage is being done. Obviously, reducing funding around immunization, you know, risks undermining decades of progress in public health. And it's critical that we put all this in the context of where children are right now. The worst global displacement crisis in history, persistent acute malnutrition, a global learning crisis. So we have this perfect storm for children. And scaling back, you know, immunization programs is going to compromise our collective ability to work for the most vulnerable. This is about the most vulnerable. And I think that's why we need to, and UNICEF is being very clear on the damage being done by these aid cuts. You know, we owe it to children to be honest about what's at stake. We owe it to partners on the ground, the local organisations who are confronting these crises every single day, whose programmes for children and women are being cut. So, you know, UNICEF is streamlined. UNICEF is the biggest supplier globally of immunisation, and we have made enormous gains. We heard that last Friday from our Deputy Executive Director. We have made historic gains, the biggest gains in child survival in the history of recorded data have been made. And that speaks to, you know, the idea that nothing defines us more than how we defend those who can't protect themselves, children. Today, there is a great risk that those most vulnerable we are turning our backs upon them.
And on your third question, maybe we'll come back to you, Agnes, on Sudan. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Hi, Alessandra. I'm sorry. I just, I mean, in the briefing, I don't know if you already spoke about Ukraine and the children in Ukraine.
No, we don't have an item on Ukraine today. But if you can, if you want to ask your question to one of the spokesperson.
Yes, yes. My question is on the announce of Trump to stop the aid to Ukraine. And also, there are a lot of children that were kind of kidnapped, Ukraine children into Russia. So I don't know what is going to happen with the children. If you have any update on the situation and the announce of Mr. Trump to stop the aid to Ukraine, what do you think? Thank you.
Thanks so much. I think the best would be to give a straight quote from UNICEF's executive director from the Security Council briefing a couple of months ago in December, which is that, quote, UNICEF remains deeply concerned about the number of children who have been separated from their families in Ukraine. We urge parties to prioritise family tracing and reunification and refrain from taking any actions that would alter a child's nationality or make it difficult for them to be reunited. All parties, all stakeholders must focus on solutions that are in the best interest of the individual child.
Thank you very much, James. I don't see other hands. So thank you very much. I'd like to thank Peter very, very much. Stay safe, Peter, and thank you very much for briefing us on this, on the situation there. Merci, and thanks, James. So let me now go to, I'm not sure everybody knows you, Claudia, so maybe I'll introduce you. Claudia Marchina is the head of communication of UNIDIR. Some of you may have already crossed her, but I just wanted to introduce you to her. You have her contact details on the list of spokespersons, and she's here to tell us about UNIDIR's global conference on artificial intelligence.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning. Yes, today I will be briefing you on our global conference on AI security and ethics, which will take place on 27 and 28 March here at the Palais in Geneva. This event is part of our Roundtable for AI Security and Ethics, a multi-stakeholder platform dedicated to fostering dialogue on AI governance in security and defense. AI is no longer a technology of the future. It is already shaping today's security landscape. From defense applications to intelligence operations, AI is transforming decision-making processes and operational strategies. As its use expands, so does the need to ensure that AI enhances security, upholds international law, and promotes stability. The increasing role of AI in security and defense presents both opportunities and challenges. While AI can enhance situational awareness, crisis response, and operational efficiency, it also raises important ethical and legal considerations. Ensuring responsible use requires clear frameworks, shared principles, and international cooperation. Currently, there are no universal rules governing AI in the military, and discussions remain fragmented. The Global Conference on AI Security and Ethics therefore provides a unique platform to bring together experts from diplomacy, defense, industry, and academia to build consensus and advance responsible AI governance. The conference will explore critical questions, including how can AI be used responsibly in security and defense, what accountability frameworks are needed to govern its use, and how can international cooperation keep pace with technological advancements. It will feature a message from the Secretary General in support of the conference, which will be read during the opening by the Undersecretary General and High Representative for Disarmament Affairs. It will present insights from over 50 global speakers selected from a diverse call for contributions, and will have keynotes from leading voices in diplomacy, defense, technology, and humanitarian sectors. The conference will also facilitate interactive discussions, including high-level panels with UN and tech leaders on AI's role in peace and security. Sessions will explore AI-induced destabilization and security risks, as well as include presentations on AI in UN peacekeeping. There will also be a regional perspective panel that will explore AI governance across different geopolitical contexts. This conference builds on the momentum of the recent UN General Assembly resolution on military AI governance, which calls for international cooperation to address AI's impact on global security. It is also informed by key research from UNIDIR, which includes a policy brief outlining 6 priority areas for AI governance in the military domain, covering transparency, accountability, human oversight, data integrity, lifecycle management, and stability risks. Other relevant UNIDIR research includes draft guidelines for national AI strategies in security and defense, and a briefing note for states on AI governance in the military domain. These resources provide policy recommendations, governance models, and risk assessments to guide national and international efforts on AI security. We hope that this conference will foster meaningful collaboration and actionable outcomes on AI governance in security and defense. You're all welcome to attend the conference in person here at the Palais or via live stream. For more information on the program and the list of speakers, I invite you to visit our website. And also, in case you have not received our press release that was issued earlier this month, and you have an interest in learning more about UNIDIR's work, please do reach out to me so you can be added to our media list. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Claudia, for this information. Any question to UNIDIR in the room? John Zarokostas, The Lancet in France.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering if you will be kind enough as to send out to the members of the press through Alessandra's office the list of participants, public, private, and from industry. And I was wondering, what is the position of UNIDIR? Companies, software companies that are involved in software in military systems, are they considered dual use companies that fall in the civilian and military domain or just in the civilian? Many of the software is using guided systems for missiles and drones, etc. Thanks.
Thank you for the question. So in terms of the list of participants, yes, I can double check to share this following the conference. And in terms of the software companies, I would have to double check with our team in terms of the categorization that you just asked. So I'm happy to write down your information and get back to you.
I see there is a question from Yuri, but I don't know. Is that for UNIDIR, Yuri?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
Hello, Alessandra. Good morning, everybody. My question is regarding the fact that Poland and the 3 Baltic countries say that they are withdrawing from the Ottawa Convention on the anti-personnel mines. I just wanted to know if UNIDIR has any comments on that, because I didn't saw, and if I missed it, I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry, I don't think I heard the beginning of the question. It was about the Ottawa Convention.
He wants to know if
Thank you. I do not have any comments on that. I can, again, double check with the relevant team so that we can provide a more informed position on that question.
Thank you very much, Claudia. I think this there are no other questions for you, so thanks for this announcement. I know, Gabriela, you have a question for James, but before asking James to come back to the podium, I'd like to give the floor to our last speaker today, who's also for UNICEF, but part of UNICEF that is launching a great contest, and I'll give him the floor. We have with us Daniel Jin Siamung, the coordinator of the International Photo Contest of UNICEF GIGA. Daniel.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Photography, when amplified by the internet, is a powerful tool to connect us to the world. That is why I'm here to speak about the GIGA Photo Contest on the theme, The Joy of Connection. GIGA, established in 2019, is a partnership between UNICEF and ITU that has mapped over 2.13 million schools in 142 countries, connected 24,000 schools, and reached 11 million students. Yet, nearly 1.3 billion children lack internet access at home. Half of the world's 6 million schools remain unconnected, affecting 500 million children and young people. To advocate for universal internet connectivity as human rights, we invite youth, students, professional photographers, photojournalists globally to submit visual stories on topics such as the impact of internet on education, on healthcare, in bridging the digital divide, accelerating participation of women and girls, and in emergency situations. This photo contest will be launched on the 1st of April with an in-person event in Geneva at the Olivia Varin Gallery with Santé la Photographie Genève from 6 p.m. onwards. Press is invited. The timeline for submitting the photographs are 30 days, the 1st to the 30th of April. These images will be judged by professional jury members on the 6th and the 7th of May in collaboration with Het Genève, the University of Arts and Design. And finally, on the 12th of June, in collaboration with the City of Geneva, we will have an outdoor exhibition and award ceremony at Parc des Bastions to celebrate the winning images. Again, join us for the contest, and we look forward to participation of photojournalists on the 1st of April. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Any question on this contest? I don't see any, but please participate, especially among those among you who are video photographer and video journalist. It's really a great occasion to speak positively for once. We really need it. Thank you very much, Daniel. And we are going to distribute the media advisory so that they will have all their information. So just a little bit of housekeeping. Gabriela has a question for James. So James, if you can come to the podium. Yuri has a question for Catherine. So if you can come to the podium. And then John, you have a question for whom?
It's a general question.
Okay. Okay, we are listening, hopefully. So Gabriela, start with your question to James on OPT, I understand.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alessandra. Thank you for giving me the floor. James, I have two questions. One on Palestine. Mr. Trump is playing with the idea of sending all the population of Palestine to other countries. So I don't know, what do you think, what is your office, if it's, you know, worry about the situation, because we know that the majority of the population are under 18. So what is gonna happen with these children, and what is this idea of Trump too? Is this an ethnic cleansing, or how do you, you know, how do you refer to this situation? I mean, this is not a game. Yeah, and then another question.
Why don't you ask both? Why don't you ask both together if they are for James, so they can answer to both?
No. My other question is for the UNIDIR, for if she has an update on Russian landmines or cluster bombs in Ukraine. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you very much. Look, I see Claudia's saying no with her head, so maybe she'll come back to you also on this. And I give the floor to James.
Yeah, Gabriela, this may be a question for OHCHR, but as you know, we have to frame these discussions consistently in international law, and we can't, obviously, as a humanitarian organisation, respond to political statements always consistently made, but we frame it around international law, and that is very clear on the forced removal or displacement of people. The Geneva Conventions is incredibly clear on that front. So while at the moment what we are focused on is is repeating, unfortunately, the same statements we've been making for 16 months, which is this must stop. It didn't, and as we've seen in the last few days, the nightmare has doubled down or doubled back upon civilians, children, women. And so here we are, Gabriela, we are repeating truths that do not need repeating. You know, we are counting trucks of life-saving aid on the wrong side of a border. We are counting countless bodies of children in Gaza. So at the moment, the focus has to be on a ceasefire, has to be on no more evacuation orders, no more displacing a population who are on their knees, and of course, an end to indiscriminate attacks upon children and getting that life-saving aid, which was actually making a sizable difference to a population under historic stress until the last 3 weeks, where it has been a blanket denial.
Thank you very much, James. Indeed, we are against any forcible displacement of populations against international law. So I guess this gives the floor to Yuri for Katerina.
Merci. Bonjour Catherine. Mes questions, c'est par rapport à la mer Noire. Je pense qu'il n'y aura pas de secret là-dessus. Il s'est passé beaucoup de choses ce week-end. La première chose, c'est qu'on a aujourd'hui Grégory Karasine, qui est un sénateur qui a participé aux négociations avec les Américains, a expliqué que lors de ces négociations, l'ONU serait invitée à participer, notamment en ce qui concerne le sujet sur la mer Noire. Et la deuxième chose, c'est que Rebecca Greenspan est actuellement à Moscou et elle a rencontré hier Sergei Vershinin pour parler de ce sujet. Donc, je voulais savoir si tout d'abord, vous aviez reçu une invitation déjà à parler de ce sujet avec les Américains, les Russes et les Ukrainiens en Arabie Saoudite. Et la deuxième chose, c'était pour savoir si avec Rebecca Greenspan hier, lors de sa rencontre avec Vershinin, il a été question de ces discussions, puisque dans le communiqué de presse qui a été publié par le ministère russe des Affaires étrangères, il a été dit et répété que l'un des sujets évoqués, c'était la sécurité du transit des céréales et des fertilisants russes en mer Noire, notamment. Donc je voulais savoir où est-ce que ça en était à votre niveau.
Bonjour Yuri, je n'ai pas d'informations sur ce qui s'est passé pendant les dans le détail, j'entends, sur lors des discussions, qui sont des discussions qui sont en cours depuis la signature le 22 juillet 2022 de l'initiative de la mer Noire et du mémorandum d'accord avec les autorités russes. Donc, je n'ai pas d'autres informations à donner là-dessus. L'objectif est bien sûr de laisser ouvert les corridors pour l'exportation de grains et de fertilisants passant par la mer Noire, donc en assurant bien sûr la sécurité sur la mer Noire. Voilà, je n'ai pas d'autres informations pour le moment.
Merci Catherine. Et la question de John, qui est une question générale.
Yes, my question is to any of the press officers that might be tuning in. With reference to meetings taking place this week in Geneva on structural adjustment of UN agencies in light of the financial crisis, can we get some of the agencies to brief the press on the latest developments? Some agencies, as we speak, are briefing member states. If they can brief the press on how big are the cutbacks, how much it affects your programs in the field, headquarters, etc., logistics, we're a bit like a broken record trying to get the facts here.
Look, I'll give the floor also to my colleagues. What I can tell you, this is a question that has already been asked, and at the last briefing that I brought to I brought the information to my colleagues. But it's the reality is that some agencies are already doing that, John. We have heard yesterday UNAIDS. We have heard other agencies. The UNICEF deputy executive director spoke here on Friday. I mean, here virtually, but here on Friday, and we are doing that. For what concerns, I can speak about UNOG. We are taking some cash conservation measures. Some have been taken in the past, some are continuing. And yes, indeed, we are informing member states. I'm happy to answer questions on that if you have any specific. Of course, I can't speak for the others, but I think we are all more or less giving you information, whether it's, you know, focused on one country or in general. Some other agencies have done press releases, but I'm happy to again ask, but I think we are talking, don't know if anybody wants to. Well, yes, UNICEF has been very, very clear on that, but I don't know, James, if you want to add something.
Just to supplement, so UNCTAD is part of the Secretariat of the UN, so the same applies to the organization. We don't have any precise details now about what's going to happen, but it's going to come.
If I might follow up, yeah. Catherine, you just mentioned you don't have specific details, but are agencies telling their donor countries the blueprints, the roadmap ahead, how many likely jobs are to be cut at headquarters or in the field if the funds don't flow in? Or are you still in the process of evaluating the potential cuts? Some agencies last week mentioned, for instance, one agency mentioned they're cutting 250 jobs in Geneva and about 6,000 worldwide. I mean, it could be nice for us to get the breakdown, what it means in a humanitarian context. Thank you.
Well noted. You have a comment?
Yeah. Only that it's what everyone is focused around everywhere. As we heard on Friday, the cuts, there is not perfect clarity, so we're continuing to assess that, you know, what those termination notices look like, particularly for UNICEF, for children, for our partners, and yes, for staff. It's bad. I mean, it's impacting millions and millions of girls and boys in roughly half the countries where we work.
And this has prompted more hands up in the platform, Yuri.
Oui, c'est un tout petit follow-up pour être sûr de pas écrire de bêtises, Catherine. Vu que c'est la première fois que les Russes reparlent publiquement de rouvrir les discussions avec les Ukrainiens via les Américains sur les passages en mer Noire, avec une invitation à l'ONU, je voulais juste savoir si je pouvais écrire clairement que pour l'instant, en tout cas, personne ne peut confirmer que l'ONU a reçu une invitation pour prendre part à ces discussions.
Je ne connais pas les détails de ce qui se passe, de ce qui s'est passé, de qui a reçu une invitation. Je n'ai pas cette information. Les discussions autour de cet accord, de ce mémorandum d'accord, n'ont jamais été interrompues. Elles continuent depuis 2022. C'est la seule chose. Je n'ai aucun détail. Je peux essayer de vérifier et revenir vers toi. Mais pour le moment, je ne peux rien confirmer ni infirmer.
C'est clair.
Gabriela.
Thank you, Alessandra. I would like to bring your attention to Mexico. And human rights is not here, but last week they found in Mexico a camp of exterminium. I mean, extermination camp with crematorias, with, forced recruitment of young people. They tortured them. I mean, it was a tragedy. So this is not the only one. Maybe there are more in Mexico. So the situation in Mexico is turning really bad. And I don't know, I mean, PAHO, they don't have human rights division. Here is a human rights division. And, you know, nobody talks about these. There are huge violations for human rights and, you know, maybe refugees because there's a lot of migrants there. So I just wanted to ask, why you don't talk about Mexico? Thank you.
I'm sorry if I contradict you here, Gabriela, but just 10 days ago, Liz Throssell was here talking about the recent discovery in Mexico of burned human remains and hundreds of personal items such as shoes and clothes at a camp reportedly run by a drug cartel. And she said it was a deeply disturbing reminder of the trauma of disappearances linked to organized crime across the country. It's a long briefing that she gave on this occasion. But I don't know if they would have any further comment on more recent discoveries and events. But obviously, as Liz said on that particular briefing, the discovering is absolutely very much disturbing. And she said at that point that the office called on the Mexican authority to guarantee that there are thorough, independent, impartial, and transparent investigation into crimes committed. And she was referring to that site, and I'm sure that would apply also to a terrible and unfortunate new discoveries. But happy to either ask her for a new comment, or maybe you can do that. Is that a new hand, Gabriela?
Yes. Because yeah, there are new things about this, and also, I mean, the army, the Guardia Nacional, was involved, and then all the evidence inside the shoes, all the things that the backpacks, everything disappeared. So there's no more evidence inside. So yes, this is a huge problem, and I hope the Office of High Commissioner they talk again about this, because this is not, you know, this is really, really huge thing in Mexico.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm happy to also ask them, please contact them, contact the colleagues again, and they will surely come back to you with comments on these terrible discoveries. If there are no other questions, I'd like to thank everyone. I've got quite a few announcements for you, so if you bear with me. First of all, I have an announcement on behalf of the Office of the Special Envoy for Syria that reminds you that the Special Envoy for Syria will brief the Security Council at 10 a.m. New York Times, which is 3 o'clock at the moment in Geneva. And of course, they will distribute the remarks after the briefing. Speaking about human rights, I'd like to remind you that the Human Rights Committee will close Friday. It's 143rd session, and the Committee on Enforced Disappeared is today speaking about Malta, the other, and which is the last country on their list. Human Rights Council continue, I don't need to tell you. Pascal is informing you regularly. Two more information for you. One is, let me take it if I can find it now, of course. Yeah. So as you know, the Conference of the Parties to the Basel, Rotterdam, and Stockholm Conventions are meeting in 2025 here in Geneva. That's going to happen between the 28th of April and the 9th of May. These three meetings, which will, as you know, happen back-to-back in Geneva, are preceded now by three briefings specifically for you, for journalists, that will take place on the 27th of March at 3 o'clock. That's Geneva time. That will be in English to gain key insights into the various COPs and learn how to engage effectively. There will be another one the day after on the 28th of March, also at 4 o'clock in Spanish, and one on the 1st of April in French, also at 4 o'clock. These briefings are online. The information has been distributed to you by us, but also by the colleagues of UNEP. And I think you can find there all the details in order to participate in this. And then, if I can find... You have a question on this, John? Yeah, go ahead. So I'm looking for my other announcement.
Alessandra,
yeah.
On this very issue, the secretariats of these agencies are based in Geneva,
yeah.
And the Geneva UN Press Corps are asked to tune in to online briefings prepared for correspondents in Madrid, Paris, and Brussels. It would have been nice for them to organise a briefing at the Palais, where they did in the past. With many of us covered mm-hmm. negotiations on the mm-hmm. Basel Convention and transboundary pollution in the Palais. It's just not right for us to be chasing online briefings plan for other capitals when we're accredited here.
I personally think it's nice to have briefing in the three languages, but yeah, a point well taken about an in-person briefing. I'll report it to them. My last point, my last announcement is that we have just distributed an invitation to you to an event to mark the 50th anniversary of the Biological Weapon Convention, which is organized by the Geneva branch of the UN Office for Disarmament Affairs. It's a series of panel discussions with international experts to discuss the present, past, present, and future of the convention. There are a great number of interesting speakers, and of course, you have the list in the invitation. So the event will take place tomorrow, Wednesday, 26th of March, from 3:15 to 6 o'clock in room 21 of the Palais des Nations. That's it. And I think there are also a couple of international days. We have sent you the statement of the Secretary General. One is the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. And the other one, the International Day of Solidarity with Detained and Missing Staff Members, to whom and whose family we think at this particular moment. If there are no other questions, let me see. Olivia.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. And this is just a question for everybody listening in. I just wanted to get some more details on the announcement yesterday from the Secretary General that the UN will reduce its footprint in Gaza following the tragic deaths of five staff members. I just would like to ask if any of the relevant agencies listening in have any details that they're able to share in terms of which operations will see their footprint reduce, how many and how soon. And what impact will that have on operations?
Yes, indeed. The Secretary General issued yesterday a statement where he said that, as you know, the past week have seen devastating strikes on Gaza, and based on the current terrible situation where no humanitarian aid is being allowed to enter into the Gaza Strip, the Secretary General has taken the difficult decision to reduce the UN footprint in Gaza, as you said, even if the humanitarian needs are soaring and our concern over the protection of civilians intensifies. Details I have is, the idea is it has to be very clear. We are not abandoning Gaza. We are in Gaza. The UN remain in Gaza. What we are trying is reducing the number of international staff members by about one third. And this is really because the Secretary General doesn't have the power of guaranteeing the safety of UN staff, in fact, whether they are international or local. So since in Gaza we currently have about 100 international staff, this is about 30 people that we are talking about. And from what I understand, the agencies that are impacted would include OCHA, WFP, UNICEF, UNOPS, UNFPA, WHO, and UNDP. So I don't know if there is anybody who has further details on this. Yes, Margaret, please come, as you are among those agencies. So we have Margaret Harris for WHO. But while Margaret is coming, I really would, or maybe just go, yeah, go ahead and I'll conclude.
Just very quickly. I don't have numbers, but I do have a clear message from our emergencies team that we will remain operational. But as Alessandra said, the critical thing is getting aid in, getting access. So even though we remain operational, what we can do is massively limited by the lack of ability to bring in aid and, of course, no safety.
Yeah, and this is exactly how the Secretary General concluded his statement yesterday, by saying that all parties must comply fully with international law at all times. Civilians must be respected and they must be protected. And the denial of life-saving aid must end, and the hostages must be released immediately and unconditionally. And he made an appeal to all states who have an impact and influence on the situation on the floor, on the ground, to use their leverage to stop the conflict and ensure respect for international law. And of course, calling for the restoration of the ceasefire to bring an end to this terrible situation. So I don't see any further end up on the platform or in the room. So thank you very much for following the briefing. Thanks to all the colleagues who have participated. And I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.